CliffCentral.com.
Good morning, everybody. We are live on a Thursday morning at 4 minutes past six. Pumelele Mashiach. Hello, Pums. How are you?
Hello, hello, hello.
Sure. You know, I thought about the show we did the other day where you and I ended up talking about emotivism for like an hour. And I suddenly thought, we can really go down a rabbit hole, you and me. Huh? I mean, it doesn't take very much.
I think it is what it is. This is the world we live in now. This is the world we live in. There's so many rabbit holes. There's so many. Remember, we also spoke about like releasing rabbits in the news. There's so many rabbits to go through.
Yeah.
To go
now,
down.
That comes up. That comes up a lot.
Now we've got GPT-4 as a whole, as a rabbit hole to go down.
They've just released this GPT-4, and I thought that 3 was pretty wild, but this is apparently even better. And it's so apparently GPT-3 was around for, you know, it's been around for like the last 3 years. We should even realize it. I asked ChatGPT.
Available to us.
Now, I asked ChatGPT some questions last night, funnily enough. I did something interesting last night. I got home. And I couldn't get to sleep. So I eventually thought, all right, well, let me watch a movie. That'll get me tired enough. And it was still early. So I thought, well, if I do this, I can get to bed by like 11:30, which is, it's late for me, but I mean, I can handle that, right? So I watched All Quiet on the Western Front in German.
Yay.
With no subtitles. I thought of you. And so the entire movie, there's not a single word of English. It's all German and a little bit of French when the French people are involved in Compiègne later on, when they sign the armistice. And I was quite impressed that I could kind of figure out my way. I mean, it's mostly an action movie, so you can tell what's going on. You don't have to be a fluent German speaker or a genius to figure this out. But I mean, it was quite something because there was no
first time watching All Quiet on the Western Front. And did you watch the new one?
The new one. The one that really should have won a whole bunch of Oscars this week, but obviously they ignored it because it was more important for them to talk about like some fat guy and body positivity. Anyway, what an interesting movie. I mean, I remember I read the book years ago, and that book was seminary because it's really, it's one of the great anti-war books, and it was written by somebody who was dead keen to get people to move away from war. And obviously, it was after World War I, and despite their best efforts, World War II came not so long after that. But my God, what a movie! Whoa. I mean, the amount of just absolute hideous bloodshed and just a massacre. I mean, again, you know, it kind of gives you perspective. I wish everybody would do a little bit of history every day because you'd be so grateful about being alive now. You know, I mean, Pumi, 17 million people got cut to pieces during that war. 17 million people. You know, we often talk about the Holocaust as being horrific, and it obviously was. You know, 6 million people lost their lives there. And it's just disgusting. You think about the Belgian Congo and what happened under Leopold there and how many millions of people lost their lives there. And you think about the American expansion in the West and what they did. Forget about, you know, the buffaloes and the bison that they completely wiped out. They just decimated every kind of wildlife. The beavers were totally exterminated. But then, of course, what they did to the local people, the Native Americans. You know, I look at humans. I look back and I think, well, all of those are kind of, those are, you know, a century or more ago. Because we're almost approaching a point now where we'll be a century since World War One. In fact, I mean, World War One is a century ago, but World War Two will almost be a century from now. And, you know, I got a new credit card, so I'm thinking about these things in very long spans of time. They delivered a new credit card to me, which is dangerous, but it expires.
oh, oh,
It expires in 2028.
All the people that have been decimated by all sorts of war and strife, all because you got a new credit card, right?
No, what I thought was we've got recent examples. I mean, what happened in Rwanda? You know, we've got the Yugoslavian situation in the 90s as well. We have Afghanistan and Iraq and what's going on in Ukraine and Russia right now. And you think, Jesus, don't we learn? Are we so goddamn stupid?
People are, what's wrong with this world?
It boggles my mind, Pumi. It boggles my mind. World War One had to have been the greatest mass slaughtering in a conflict situation that has ever been recorded. I mean, the battle site at Verdun is still the there may be grass growing there now, and you know what look like little ponds, but those are the remains of craters.
Yeah, if you don't even have to go far. If you go down to Isandlwana, if you go down to Blood River, if you go, you mm-hmm. know, there it's horrendous what people can do to each other. It reminds me, you know, Bob Marley, in one of his amazing songs, has a lyric that says, "Verbal conflict is a waste of words, and physical conflict, like war, is a waste of flesh."
Right. I mean, while I found the movie,
young, but when you see
these are young kids. What's
also amazing about All Quiet on the Western Front is you see how young soldiers are.
Well, I mean, at one point they're at school, and then, you know, the headmaster of the school announces to them, "Guys, you're going to the Western Front," and they're excited. They're like, "Oh my God, we're going to fight for the Vaterland," you know? And you see these kids go off to war, and they're excited. They're marching and singing songs about the Mädchen and, you know, Liebe and all this kind of thing.
Because they're doing World War II, right? Because they still do that in history at school. So we started watching the old one a couple of weeks ago. Also, because he's a boy, and I suppose war and guns and all of that kind of stuff is amazing and fascinating for him.
Yeah.
And he loves history. And when we were watching those first scenes, when you see them in the van as they're like driving off and they're singing there, and then they're walking, marching along, it was, even for Kanego, it was quite like harrowing, you know? And I was like, yeah, they're young. So he's 15. Those boys were 2, maybe 3 years older than him.
there's this one scene where, you know, he's trying to, the main character, Paul, he's trying to like get away from ordnance that's being dropped all around him. And he sees a Frenchman, you know, this is obviously trench warfare. So it's the most horrible, brutal kind of thing, because you just get mowed down by machine gun fire and, you know, and shelling and flares and
you're already
grenades.
In the hole.
And you're already,
already
in the hole.
In the hole. They're just going to like.
Exactly.
Throw dirt over you.
He sees this shell explode right next to this French guy who is about to shoot him. I mean, like he's about to die. So he jumps into the water of this revolting crater that is now filled with bodies and mud and gunpowder and shit and piss and God knows what else. And he wades through this to the other side, and he has to stab this Frenchman to death in order to make sure that the Frenchman doesn't kill him, because this is what it boils down. And he looks at him for a second, and he sees that this is a kid his own age, but that this kid has a picture in his pocket of either his wife and his daughter, or his mother and his sister, or something. Once he stabbed him, and I mean, he takes a horribly long time to die, this Frenchman, and he's spluttering and choking. And I watched this and I suddenly thought, Jesus, you know, I have the temerity to complain about traffic.
Listen, yeah, I think people, that this is the other thing about that film. Oof. So I haven't seen the new one. Is it in black and white or is it in color?
No, it's in color. And it's beautifully made. It really is beautifully made. It's not as long as I expected it to be because I was expecting a really long, tedious movie. And I have to say, I mean, the stories I'm telling now are revolting and harrowing and may put off a lot of people. But it's also a terribly, terribly inspiring story because it again reminds you of what happened, only 100 years ago, for God's sake.
And so that I don't know if it's the same scene, but in the black and white film, when he's stabbing that guy and how long he takes to die, also
Yo.
because this is an anti-war film,
Yes.
they were making a point. But most films, which is how most of us kind of see the killing and dying of people, we think it's quick. We think it's, but actually it takes a, even though the human body is soft, it takes a lot to kill a person.
Yes.
You know, you
Yes.
to stab them and shoot them, and it's not quick. It's not quick like we've come to understand from all the films that we see. It's a gory and terrible thing, and just the brute force of a stab, you know, all that flesh you have to cut through, and it's hectic, hectic.
Well, there's also
Okay,
this
now I
thing
can't
about,
wait to watch it.
you will, I think you'll enjoy it also because it'll force you to kind of get your German back up because I know you find any opportunity you can to speak a little bit of German.
Listen, I was at the opening of the new office for the Friedrich Naumann Foundation,
Yeah.
Cecilia. She's
Right.
radiant and wonderful. Remember, we went with her
Of
to Berlin.
course.
And I met, well, it's the second time, but I saw him there again. Did I tell you this about the current German ambassador, who's the ambassador for South Africa, Lesotho,
Yes.
Swaziland, and that he speaks Zulu? So
That's bloody amazing. That's
how
really
wonderful
cool.
is that?
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine you exercising yourself in the other two languages that you speak fluently. That's great.
So, a Zulu-speaking
Yeah.
German ambassador and a German-speaking black girl at the same party. It was quite a party. It was wonderful.
I love it. Somebody says here, you don't have to worry because there's hope for us. I think it's Yonder says, soon all the old farts will be dead, which Muzi says is going to be when things really start to change, and only transgenders and keyboard warriors will be left. And they're not fighting any wars. So yeah, maybe. But we all think, oh,
Oh,
well,
there will
I'm an
always be people willing to get into physical conflicts. You just see it. You see it now. You watch one stupid fight on Twitter, and then you just see people throwing chairs at McDonald's, people like throwing skateboards at each other. Like, it's just people will always find ways to get into physical conflict. And if
DK
they can
points
do it
out
on a mass scale.
one of the big things from this movie. Young soldiers don't know or hate each other, but they're expected to kill each other. Politicians know each other, hate each other, but don't kill each other. They're dirty bastards. Well, this is
Dirty
another thing.
bastards.
It comes up in the movie that the generals and the politicians obviously are so disconnected from what's going on the battlefield. Always are, right? I mean, you see politicians all over the world saying, well, we'll send troops, we'll send military aid, we'll do this, we'll do it. And then they make like a midnight visit when everything is calm and quiet or when the sirens have gone down. Yeah. And
Back
then they're
channel
like, well,
conversations.
I visited the front. Like they expect some kind of medal just for being there when they're the ones who ordered these young men
Who
to go there.
started
It's just,
it? I was at a book launch last night, but by a
You
friend.
are busy. You really get around, huh? Look at you. Jesus,
Listen,
if
now that
I'm
things
so glad I don't have
are
your social schedule. I mean, these days, honest to God, you'd need a crowbar to get me out of my house. And it's not because I'm frightened of COVID or any of that bullshit. I mean, I'm really not. I'm back in the world, but oh my God, for me to put me the amount of what is the opposite of FOMO? We came up with a term for it.
the joy of missing out.
Yes, JOMO. That's right. I have so much Jomo when I know I don't have to go anywhere. I'm like so excited. Listen to you. You've got like this. You're at the Friedrich Naumann Stiftung. You're at the book launch for a friend of yours. You're in the middle of KZN Monday to Wednesday. I don't know how you do it. And you've got a son.
Because it's at boarding school. That's how I do it.
Wow, look at you.
The joy of not picking up and dropping off. That's what I have.
Yeah. Just quickly, Mapelo says, what's the name of the movie? It's called All Quiet on the Western Front. Or in German, what do they call it? Westfront.
No. Nichts. Als nicht. Yeah. No. Als. Let me look. Let me look, and then we can say it in the original.
Because I quite enjoyed doing it in German, you know. I thought that was quite fun. Oh, shit, my microphone's been on the wrong thing the whole time. You guys have been hearing the most terrible sound. Is that better?
Wow.
Oh, God, I'm so sorry. How irritating. I must have sounded like I was broadcasting from World War I.
I thought it was...
Hello.
Hello, everybody.
Invest in Nichts Neues. That's the name of the book.
Nichts Neues, which means nothing new. Anyway,
yeah, listen. Invest in Nichts Neues.
You went to a book launch and I interrupted you.
So this is part of, and the name of the book by Mike Decker is the author. And the name of the book is Collegiality. The Future of Leadership is Collegiality.
We're going to speak to Mike about that book soon. The publisher. Nice. Yeah, awesome. But you and Muzi know Mike Teke from years ago, right?
Well, Muzi grew up with him. He is, and Muzi told the story. Muzi was hosting the launch, and Muzi told the story yesterday that Muzi has lots of brothers and sisters, but for his father's lineage, as Muzi puts it, first is his sister. And then it is Mike, and then it's all the rest of them. So that's how close they are.
Wow. Sheesh.
And but his entire book, and he's a fantastic business leader and has done incredibly well in business in South Africa. And he talks about the things that he's had to unlearn as a leader. And one of his biggest things, and hence the name of the book, is that the future of leadership, if you're going to be a good leader in any environment, whether it's business or home or in your life, it's going to be about being collegial, being able to have tough conversations without being a dick. He doesn't say that, obviously, because he's a much nicer person. But one of the things that he talks about, and he says it's not in his book, and it's because they made a decision with his editor to leave it out, but that the world would be so much of a better place if some countries, the leaders of those countries, learned to be collegial with each other.
we can't even get the leaders in this country to be collegial with each other. We'll be talking to Herman Mashaba a little bit later on, because obviously there's this national shutdown that the EFF are going to push for on Monday. I heard that already they are, you know, arranging tires on like Catherine Street and all kinds of things. So
on Catherine, that's just down the road from here. That is
exactly.
That is not true.
It's what I heard on the news yesterday. I mean, it might be fake news. This is the problem. You never know, right?
Sounds like fake news.
But we've got a clip of Julius Malema criticizing Herman Mashaba. And it's not like he's criticizing. And look, I know you also have issues with the way Herman does things, and you have a valid point to make. But you at least make the point about Herman's argument. You play the ball instead of the man. Julius seems to play the man instead of the ball at every given opportunity. And
that's what he wants.
Julius
doesn't have a collegial bone.
Right. It's the opposite of what Mike Teck is talking about in his book. And I just feel like all of our leaders are so amateurish about what they do in this country. I mean, even in the comments section here, you know, Thurence Cameron says, your opinion on the Gaten McKenzie, Herman Mashaba, Helen Ziller, Biz Africa interview, please. Now, I haven't seen this, but they accuse the DA of saying that they will form a coalition with the ANC if need be. Why should the DA not be allowed to form a coalition with the ANC if they think that's the best way to rule? I mean, if you take the good and the bad from the ANC and the DA and you wrap them up, they are still the biggest two parties in the country. Maybe together they can be a check and balance on each other and get more done than all these rats and mice parties. But of course, people also, because we're obsessed with individuals rather than the parties, I mean, nobody knows what the party manifestos are in the whole world except you, Pumi. And Therence also says, off topic, Helen Ziller is the stumbling block to a coalition government. Now, here's this one old lady, because that's what she is. You know, you may hate Helen Ziller, you may love her. Here's this one old lady who's still like the boogeyman to all these other rats and mice parties, because this woman single-handedly showed the greatest ability to grow a party in the last 15 years, all on her own. One woman, and everybody in these small parties is terrified of her. She must be, even at her advanced age, she must be the most effective politician in South Africa, whether you like her or not, right? You got to admit that. And if she's the stumbling block, it's like an obsession these people have with her.
Did you see the thread that Gareth van Onselen put out a couple of days ago, just about the numbers? The numbers, you know, the DA numbers.
Way, he's no fan of Helen Ziller, Gareth van Onselen. They do not get along. He was among the first to criticize her back in the old days.
Listen, I think Lungile Phenyane, and I've been looking for a picture of her. I think she's out there vying for all available positions as they head into their conference at the DA. So maybe there's somebody out there giving old Helen a run for her money.
Well, I mean, it's about time, right? Because she is tired and old, and she probably wants to get the hell out. I'm sure she doesn't want to be the only one flying the flag anymore. You think she still wants to be there, huh?
Well, she said as much. This was in the Sunday papers, that her job is not done.
Well, maybe her job's just not done because no one else is stepping up. I mean, if it was her time and there was a successor, and maybe it's her fault for not grooming a successor. I mean, they tried with that really disappointing Musi Maimane, but that didn't amount to anything. So maybe she's desperate for a successor, but she can't leave until that happens, because she'll leave this vacuum and then it'll be filled by a, you know, loser. I don't know. I mean, I'm more impressed with her and the fact that she has been cogent and she's been consistent every step of the way. You don't have to like Helen Ziller. You don't have to agree with her. But just admit that in terms of all the standards we create all over the world for politicians, she actually bats way above her average on almost everything. And as a woman who's constantly being, you know, criticized for her personality and her gender and her age and God knows what else, she's actually done a very good job. I mean, compare her to Cyril. I mean, like, he just sits there. He's like a lump. He just, you know. Anyway, I mean, we'll save some of this for the burning platform. There are lots of opinions here. Can I ask you quickly? Are you just because you're very sensible about these things? And I, you know, there are a lot of people who are very nervous about Monday with the national shutdown, because the EFF have pretty much said they're going to go around to businesses and they will loot and attack any businesses that are open. And there are people in this country who are genuinely afraid, because we know our police force is useless. And there are other people who are actually ready for a fight, which worries me even more. How do you feel about this, Pums?
I actually didn't even realize that Monday was the 20th until a couple of days ago when we were looking at diaries, trying to set stuff up. I didn't even realize Monday was the 20th. I'm quite ambivalent about it. I think people are afraid because our government is useless. People are afraid because we know that we can't trust the police. And this is exactly what Julius and his, you know, and his bots need. They need exactly that. And they're trying, I saw some clips of the press conference yesterday, and really they're trying to goad everybody into this fight. You know, it's like, it's not a march. It's a protest. We are not going to be peaceful about it. All of that is just like, oh God. But that's what they want, right? That's exactly what they want, is they're itching for a fight. But we were talking about the war earlier. None of those people have ever faced down flying bullets. Most of them don't even know what tear gas feels like. No. They really, really are people with struggle envy. And that's what they Julius even made the comment that it's going to be like, you see, because March 21, as you know, Sharpeville Day.
Human Rights Day, Sharpeville Day, yeah.
It's going to be like Sharpeville. Let them come with their guns. Suga. And then I saw the taxi driver saying, don't you dare fuck with us and our business. I saw people there. I was like, they're hoping to goad everyone into some kind of fight. I don't think it's going to be that at all.
I hope you're right, because then it would be a damp squib and it'll give them absolutely no power. I think one of the worst things that could happen is that it provokes and sparks actual conflict in certain places. I mean, for example, you know, there's someone here in the comments who's saying, Carl, he says, everyone with a gun must take it to work on Monday. I think that's what they're hoping for, so they can make it look like there's a massive war and that they somehow are on the right side of it. I mean, Pumi's making a very valid point here. Maybe it'll just be a nothing, a big nothing burger.
Mm.
That would be the best possible outcome.
Right? I mean, already it's, you know, already we know South Africans, all of us, the day before a public holiday that extends the weekend into a super long weekend like this is usually a quiet day anyway. It's a quiet day in the shops.
Everyone can see right through their ploy here. The reason that they're doing it on Monday is because it's pretty much a dead day anyway. So it'll look like they've mobilized people. But actually, a lot of businesses have already given themselves the day off. And they've given all their staff the day off. So a lot of people won't be going to work anyway on Monday. Apparently, it's a school holiday.
It is a school holiday. It's always a school holiday on a Monday. Schools will try anything to get out of like a school day. If it's a Monday before a public holiday, if it's a Friday after a Thursday public holiday, it's not going to be, you know, like people. Yeah. And here's the thing, right? We know the numbers. We know what the unemployment numbers look like. We know that there are a lot of people hanging out in the townships anyway because they don't have anywhere to go because they don't have work. Is it going to, you know, are they going to create a spark of violence? Maybe they will. But I don't think that they're going to get the kind of traction and reaction that they are hoping for. There's just too much sentiment against them.
Well, somebody in the comments also said that there are tires being put up all over the place and they're actually taking them away. Don says the tire stories are correct. We're collecting them all over Joburg. And someone else says, sure. I heard they're already putting tires in key places and people have been asked if they see random tires to pick them up. The word on the street is that they won't have time on Monday. Well, I mean, I saw the police commissioner, right? And I'm only paying attention to this because obviously we've got a business and I don't want anybody having to put themselves in harm's way if there is something going on. And they always seem to do this in Sandton and that's where we are. So you have to think about these things, even though.
Are they going to, I thought they were going to Pretoria, no?
Angas, who knows? I mean, apparently the N1 highway, you know, the EFF, for example, they sat on the M1 highway once and just blocked the whole thing. Do you remember that? That wasn't so long ago.
And we remember that there weren't a lot of people there.
No.
I think it was a busload of people.
I drove past it. Yeah, it was like 15 people and the police were nowhere to be seen. Now the police should just take them away.
Mm.
You know, just clap them in irons and take them away. put them in jail for a long time, wait till the trial, make it like 8 months from now that they eventually get tried for this, and they can find out what it's like to really be a struggle hero, because that's what they want, right? They want to know what it's like, these EFF people who are completely out of touch with what it's really like to actually face the full might of a government, not just this amateurish Keystone Cops government we have. And if they did, maybe they would stop it and they'd think about it next time. But I think that almost empowered them, because they thought, oh, well, the police did nothing to us here. They won't do anything to us the next time. Who knows?
I think that they're a little bit sad that, because they do have one trick, and their trick is a big show against whoever, you know. So initially it was all a big struggle against Jacob Zuma, and that's what they were on. They were, and I think that they are a little bit sad that not everybody has gotten on board with their get rid of Cyril trope, the same way that everybody was on board with the get rid of Zuma trope, you know. So when it was the anti-Zuma march, they were all there. I think you remember this. There's everybody keeps putting up the picture of all of them, UDM, DA, EFF, IFP, all of them together, locked hands, and, you know. And I think that they're sad that they don't have the same traction this time around. That's why, you know, when you're shouting, that it's because you don't feel listened to. So when Julius calls a press conference and is shouting into the microphone, that's what that is. He's not being listened to.
We reached out to the EFF and asked them to come on the show today. They have said no, thank you. They started off saying yes, and we were going to get one of the spokespeople on, because Julius is very important and he's preparing for a conference they're having today about this protest on Monday. Then the spokesperson said, no, we've decided everything we have to say, we will say it up at our Congress. So, I said to Ryan.
A press conference,
whatever it is. Anyway, they're not coming on today, but we will have Herman Mashaba. We will also have Ian Cameron on, who we spoke to not so long ago about his new book. And he was the guy who heroically stood up to the police in Cape Town. And he's an activist. He's an ordinary citizen activist, and somebody who is, I think, trying to make a difference in his small way. And he has some things to say about the national shutdown on Monday too. We were supposed to also have Jordan Hill Lewis, the mayor of Cape Town, who put out a video last week already saying that there will be no national shutdown in Cape Town. Business.
They also had a press conference about it.
Yep.
They had a press conference, and they were going to court. I think interdicting.
Just like the EFF, Jordan Hill Lewis is now not available to talk to us this morning. So between Julius and the mayor of Cape Town, they're just too busy and important to talk to us, but it's fine. We'll talk to Herman and we'll speak to Ian Cameron, and we're going to get into that in the Burning Platform next. All of that and more on the way. We've got a couple of comments here. We've got Congo Chris saying, I think they saw how you ripped that oak from the PA apart last time a political spokesperson came on the platform. God, that was a bloodbath. And I think they're talking about...
Do you know he's now a mayor?
I think they're talking about you, Pumi, not me.
No, not me.
What was his name, that guy? What was his name? From the
Saul Patriotic... something the first.
Something Saul's, yeah.
The first.
And he's a mayor somewhere now?
In the Karoo. This is where the Patriotic Alliance is assembling... The all-star Avengers of whatever it is that they're up to.
Well, anybody who had any, who was excited about Gayton McKenzie's bunch, I mean, I think that has also been, that flame has been put out properly. There's water poured all over that fire. I don't think that's exciting. Ashley Sauls is the guy's name. Anyway, you see how we struggled, and we've spoken to him. We actually had like a proper fight with him on the air because he was so out of it. Anyway, I think it's all lots of fun. We can get into the politics later on. Let's look at a couple of headlines, because we always get carried away with something and then we don't look at the headlines. So first of all, Black Coffee is going to be the first South African DJ to perform at Madison Square Gardens in New York this October. How cool is that? I mean, Madison Square Garden's a hell of a venue. I don't know how many DJs have ever actually played in Madison Square Gardens, because, you know, they may have the odd festival there or whatever, but it's usually for concerts. And I think this is quite a big achievement. So again, well done to Black Coffee. There are a lot of people saying, oh, his time is up. It's, you know, it's time for new people to come in. And Zeg Spontini is now the flavor of the moment because he just won a Grammy. But I think Black Coffee, there's still a lot of good shit coming out of there. So let it happen.
Oh, there's still a lot of party in him.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And this is the cool thing about being a DJ, because unlike being a performer on stage, you don't have to jump around. You don't have to have like the athleticism of being a performer, even though performers are still out there in their 70s. Their 70s, actually. But, you know, being a DJ, you're protected by the DJ booth, and it's wonderful. I think he's still got a lot of music in him.
There is also a difference between DJs who play other people's music and DJs who actually produce their own music, which is the case for Black Coffee. So that's why one of the reasons he's such a big deal and should be. A pilot made the first ever plane landing on the Burj Al Arab helipad. You know that helipad? They've played tennis on there before. It's not a very big space, so I don't know how the hell they did this. But according to the story, I mean, again, there are some wacky people out there who are prepared to do some pretty wild things. this guy, it's one of those Red Bull planes. He made aviation. His name is Lukasz Japiela. He made aviation history on Tuesday, becoming the first person to land a plane on the helipad of the iconic Burj Al Arab Jumeirah Hotel in Dubai. And I mean, I've got a picture of it I can show you. Let me just see.
Yes, please.
Yes. So they've done all kinds of things on the roof of this helipad, or on this helipad before, including played soccer matches, played tennis matches. They're famous pictures of, you know, it's this sort of round thing on the top of that building that looks like a sail on a ship.
Listen, those buildings are crazy. I remember seeing the video of Tom Cruise walking on that Burj Khalifa.
Yes.
And I'm just thinking, I've been in that building. It's so high. It's so dizzying when you're up there. It's actually quite crazy. So this kind of like madness, this kind of, you see, this is what happens when you don't have like big wars anymore. People are looking for thrills in all sorts of crazy things.
No, it's extraordinary that, you know, somebody could do this. And he managed to land and basically just stopped his plane right in the middle of that circle. And there's not a lot of space there. It's absolutely incredible. So this must be a very, very experienced and tremendously accomplished and skilled pilot to have got this right, because man, that does not look easy. And if you see those tires, maybe they just, he pumped the brakes so goddamn hard on this thing.
Dude, he had to like land and take off. It's crazy.
Yeah. No, it's wild. I mean, listen, this is what's amazing to me about human beings. Like, someone is prepared to do that, because obviously the risks here are enormous. Can you imagine? Anyway,
good for him.
So that happened. Then there was a Banksy mural, which appeared on a derelict farmhouse. And what's amazing about this story is that they actually destroyed the building eventually. But I'm not a huge fan of Banksy. I mean, I think, you know, street art's great and all the rest of it. But I know people have paid gazillions for this. But the mural's called Morning is Broken. And it shows a young boy who opens the curtains that are made of corrugated iron alongside a cat. I mean, it's actually a really lovely mural. I'll show it to you in a second. But the anonymous artist, they still don't know who Banksy is, confirmed that they were creator of the post, the piece in a post shared to Instagram. The artwork appeared on the side of a derelict farmhouse. Owners of the land said demolition work is currently being undertaken at the site. In February, another installation created by Banksy called Valentine's Day Mascara was dismantled by the local council. It was later confirmed the piece would be taken to the town's Dreamland theme park. So they're going to destroy the building, but they're not going to destroy the artwork. So here is the picture. I think it's actually really pretty. It looks like, you know, just the silhouette of a little boy and a cat inside of curtains that have been pushed apart by the little boy. The curtains made of corrugated iron. It's beautiful. I mean,
That corrugated iron, this is really cool. It's like when you see, because it was there. The iron was there. It was like a broken piece of corrugated iron against this. Mm. And then just making that little boy and cat.
Right.
It's quite a wonderful way of seeing. Right?
That's lovely.
Looking at those two pieces of corrugated iron and thinking, oh, that looks like a curtain. Maybe somebody opening a curtain.
This is genius. I mean, this is why the guy is, you know, one of the most famous artists in the world right now, Banksy. Anyway, they are destroying the farmhouse, but they're going to save the mural and they're going to take it to a local park or museum or whatever, because it's extremely valuable, of course. Mm. So there we go. Another beautiful piece of art that just appeared, because this is what Banksy does. He doesn't warn anybody. He goes in the dead of night and does his work, and nobody ever knows it's there until the next morning when they wake up and they suddenly have this million-pound artwork on the wall. It's pretty cool. Oh, wow. Listen to this. Adam says the pilot that in question for the Burj Al Arab, this pilot did 680 landings on a template before landing on that hotel room. Yeah, so, I mean, wow.
What?
680 landings to practice so you get it exactly right.
When you do these kinds of things, when you see people who are doing these kinds of things, like landing in a precarious spot, or even like when you watch gymnastics, right? So when they do their triple jumps and whatnot, I always think about the practice, because you have to practice. You're not doing it just for the first time. And I wonder, like, how many times that gymnast or whoever has fallen to be able to get that right. So 680 landings to get that one right is incredible.
Mm-hmm. No, it's amazing. Congo Chris says, Banksy's overrated, vacuous pop art nonsense. The fact that his work is valuable and antithetical to what he set out to achieve in the first place. Hey, there's always going to be a critic, Congo Chris. There's always somebody who doesn't like the work, right?
Haters go hate.
I mean, this is the nice thing about art, is it's so subjective. You know, someone might pay £1 million for a painting on the wall, but you and I might hate it. They think it's worth $1 million. We wouldn't pay 10 rand for it. That's what makes art so exciting and so interesting. And one person's taste is exactly the opposite of another person's. And Brian May, who has been doing his damnedest to be as important as his once, you know, bandmate, Freddie Mercury, has finally been acknowledged by King Charles III and received a knighthood. Brian May is now Sir Brian May. So isn't that exciting? You care about that? So
do you think that's the bribe for performing at the coronation?
Well, I think he's performed a couple of times at the party at the palace and so on. So, you know, Queen have been a big part of performing with the royal family's events over the years. So I'm sure that this was a long time coming. In fact, Brian May was probably going, what the fuck do I have to do to get these people to give me a knighthood?
But with all the reports of all the people that are not honoring the invitation to perform, I'm wondering if that's all correlating.
So first of all, they have been asked to perform at a concert after. They're not going to be performing at the coronation. The coronation is a religious event. So it's not like Elton John's going to be sitting there going, "Hey, under the sea, me, you live your life like a candle in the wind." You know, you've asked Brian May to come out while the crown's being put on the king's head. It's not going to happen. I mean, these guys are. So what they've been asked to do, all these artists, is they've been asked to, for free, perform at some big concert that they're doing in Hyde Park, either on the day or the day after the coronation or that night or whatever. And a lot of these people have been booked up, and they're like, well, why should I do
important for things like this, right? Because this is one of the ways that you can create a huge pull factor for crowds, because mm-hmm. otherwise people aren't interested. Like, you know, people won't go to church for their own soul salvation. Now they must come sit through a whole like series of a heavy crowd putting on top of a person's head. So you've got to give them a carrot. You've got to give them a big carrot. And concerts. Oh my God, a rock concert, a free concert with all these big names. That's the way to get like hundreds of thousands of people interested.
I am a traditionalist. I love some of these things. I love the fact that there's still a king somewhere and that there are going to be soldiers marching in fancy uniforms and that there'll be pomp and pageantry and all that stuff. I like that. I mean, I might not be the biggest royalist in the world, but I'm certainly not a, you know, an anti-monarchist. And to me, it's always hilarious to see these Brits who go out into the street, because I mean, this is just way too far down the track for me. I would never do this. But these ones who set up tables, they set up tables in the street and they make horrible, horrible British food. And then they put up fucking bunting. What is it with the Brits and bunting? Those little triangular bits of colored paper or whatever that they put down the street. They just love that. They love doing that. And then they all sit outside and drink tea and
red, white, and blue bunting.
Yes, always. And, you know, then they interview people for the TV news and they go around to these horrible little towns where, I mean, this is the most exciting thing that's happened in 70 years in that town, you know, and they'll go up to some old lady and they're like, hello, ma'am. Are you excited about the coronation? And this little crooked, bent over, hunchbacked, snaggle-toothed woman will go, oh, I love the king. It's my favorite thing in the whole world. I get so excited with the coronation. And you think, wow, nothing's changed. It's still the 1400s.
What I love most about all those vox pops is seeing the English people, like seeing the people of the, whoa. Hey,
yeah.
Hey. Yes. Seeing the English people, you say snaggle-toothed old, bent over old. It's not the old ones. I mean, when you're old, you can understand this person's lived through a lot. It's the like bean-shaped middle-aged ones that I'm just always so like
wearing tracksuits. Tracksuits in the middle of the day with like a pram. You know those prams that are like three children in them.
Wow.
And the hair tied up on the head. And then you ask them, what are you doing today? And they go, they can't speak properly. It's unbelievable. It's
mind-blowing. They also to hear the English people speaking English. Wow. Mm.
Well, there's also, so many different. I mean, the funniest thing about English, right, is that there are just in England, forget about Scotland and Ireland and, you know, even farther flung places like New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, or wherever else the British Empire used to go. But in just England, inside the British Isles, just in England, there are like 500 different varieties of English accent. And people all think, if they've never been there, that England is this homogenous. Please, a Cornish English person has nothing in common with a Yorkshireman, who has nothing in common with some, you know, Cockney from Essex, who has nothing in common with, you know, someone from Hertfordshire. I mean, there's some absolutely amazing linguistic differences between them. They can tell the difference straight away. To us, it all just sounds kind of like some mushed up version of the same thing.
Garbled.
And then those are just geographic differences. The other problem with England is that they also have huge class differences. So the way that people speak also gives you an idea of what social class they come from. And trust me, everybody talks about how England is this egalitarian and equal place. It's not. There are still huge differences between the people who go to private schools and the people who go to public schools, the people who grew up in, you know, a certain social class and the people who grew up in another. Massive differences. And that's just in England. We're not even going to get to the other places. But it's just absolutely amazing. So I'm looking forward to that this year. When is it? In May.
In May. Of course we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
These things are worth watching.
Yeah, I think also they put on a good show, you know. So we won't be putting up bunting, and I could care less about, you know, waving a little flag with King Charles's face on it. I mean, that's not something I'll be doing, but I will be watching the show and I'll be enjoying it, because this ceremony is actually 1,000 years old, this coronation ceremony.
And has been planned to the T, over the past 18 months, but it's been years. Like somebody had to dust off that little plan that they had. Somebody at the BBC had a plan that's been passed from CEO to CEO and operations guy, and dusted off and relook at and updated for today. But that thing has been, it's going to be amazing. It's kind of like when we watched the funeral, right?
You could see. Everything was meticulously planned. This is something the English do well. I mean, when I went to London with Sia, what was it, 5-6 years ago, we met with a guy called Garter King of Arms. This is a guy who has the job. He works for the College of Arms, okay? And the College of Arms falls under a man called the Earl Marshal. And the Earl Marshal is the Duke of Norfolk, who is the most senior aristocrat in England. And he is the one who hereditarily plans these things. So the Earl Marshal and the College of Arms get together, and they, every couple of years, they update the coronation book. But it's this fat book full of things from everything from like 1066 to 1300 to 1500 to 1728. And they bring this out, and then that's how they plan these things. And I spoke to the guy for about 20, 30 minutes. And it was fascinating, because he was also the one who was there at the burial of the Queen and Prince Philip. And, you know, it's an incredibly like old and dusty office, that this man belongs to. It's like a lot of the stuff that he would have been, that would have made him hugely important back in those days, is completely out of date now. And nobody takes it seriously. But wait till the coronation rolls around. This is his moment to shine.
Right? Dude, there have been people in that job waiting for a day such as this who retired. With this day never arriving. Can you imagine having a job that you're like prepared for this moment, and you are there waiting your entire career, comes and goes, and this moment doesn't come?
Come on, the Queen's lived too long. But I mean, that's kind of how, that's sort of why I like King Charles and everybody else doesn't. I feel sorry for the guy. I'm like, this poor man is in his 70s. He's finally allowed to do this job. He's finally allowed to take this job on, which he's been preparing for his whole life.
Waited his whole life.
God, his mother died in her late 90s, in her mid-90s. This old woman's hanging on by a thread. This guy's like, for God's sake, can I finally do the job that you've been preparing me for 70 years to do?
I think the worst thing about it is most people are kind of, by that age, most people are looking forward to not having to do a job, right? They're looking forward to just doing the stuff that they love, doing their garden, doing. And now he has to hope that he lives another 20 years like his mom, to be as old as his mom, so he can at least have 20 years in the job.
It's like being in I had an electrician here at my house a while ago, installing the solar, right? And this guy's like, and this is my apprentice. And he introduces me to his apprentice who's working with him. He's this 20 something Afrikaans guy. And I thought, sure, this guy he's doing it the old school way. You have to learn a trade like that from, you know, someone who's a master. And then there's an apprentice who learns from the master. And it's like King Charles has been an apprentice for 70 years of his life, just waiting for the chance to actually do it. Anyway, we'll see what happens. And then someone says, can Charles's sausage fingers grasp the scepter? Oh, people are mean.
Don't be that person, man. Don't be that person.
Anyway, we'll see what happens. Apparently, there's a 53-year-old longevity researcher who says that his biological age is a decade younger thanks to 4 daily habits. Do you want to know what those are quickly before we get to 7 o'clock?
Do it.
All right. So here are the 4 things that this guy, who's been researching longevity for ages, says have reduced his biological age. All right, so he's 53. Let me show you what he looks like. He doesn't look 53. All right, so there may be some proof in the pudding here. I'll show you a picture of him, but he says, his name is David Sinclair. He says biological age is actually reducible. And basically, he says he's got a couple of clues, a couple of hacks that he's worked out. He said you need a plant-based diet. So I'm just happy.
I'm out.
Yeah, I'm out as well. Cutting out alcohol. Again, I'm out. Sorry. If you want to do this, you go ahead, guys. I mean, I'm still going to give it to you, the information you need. But Pumi and I are probably out just for those first two. So he says, first of all, it starts with nutrition. He's written a book called Lifespan, Why We Age and Why We Don't Have To. Apparently, he said he drinks one or two green tea matchas daily that are prepared by his partner. They have got molecules in them that prevent cancer, among other things like anti-inflammatory properties. He says green tea consumption may be linked to a lower risk of stomach cancer. So first of all, do that. He also says he takes a bunch of supplements. He does intermittent fasting. He's cut back on the frequency of his meals. I try to pack my main meal into a few hours of the day wherever possible. And that period of fasting also has great benefits for my estimated biological age. He says you've got to reduce stress and avoid horrible people. Now, this I agree with.
This we should all do. This we Everyone should all should. Do. And we should avoid being horrible people.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, exercise. So it's eat properly, avoid bad people and stress, exercise regularly. And what did I leave out? Intermittent fasting. Okay. Don't so if drink. You can do those four things. So let me show you what this guy looks like. This is supposedly a 53-year-old. Okay. And if you think that he's full of shit, then obviously don't follow any of these rules, but this is the guy. And frankly, to me, he doesn't look 53. So he might be onto something. I just don't know what a green tea matcha is, but maybe I'll figure that out along the way. There we are. 53. What do you think, Pumi?
Yeah, but I wouldn't want to live long if I couldn't have a glass of bubbly now and then, or sure. A glass of gin and tonic. Why? What am I living long for?
Or eat meat. I mean, imagine not being able to have a steak. For God's sake, that would be my last meal if I were in death row. It would be a steak. Anyway, all right, that's all we got for you in this hour. We've got the Burning Platform coming up next. We'll be checking in with Ian Cameron, who I'm very pleased to be welcoming back to the show. Herman Mashaba will be joining us too. We've got lots to talk about, especially that EFF march, which is planned for Monday. The protest that Julius is all fired up about. That's coming up next. Don't go anywhere. CliffCentral.com. It is a Thursday morning. CliffCentral.com.